Doomsday Book, Cassette 13.
Book 3. Buried with my own hands, 5 of my children in a single grave. No bells, no tears. This is the end of the world. Agnola di Tura, Siena, 1347. Chapter 24. Dunworthy spent the next 2 days ringing Finch's list of techs and Scottish fishing guides and setting up another ward in Bulkley Johnson. 15 more of his detainees were down with the flu, among them Miss Taylor, who had collapsed 49 strokes short of a full peel. Fainted dead away and let go her bell, Finch reported. It swung right over with a noise like doom, and the rope thrashed about like a live thing, wrapped itself around my neck and nearly strangled me. Miss Taylor wanted to go on after she came to herself, but of course it was too late. I do wish you'd speak to her, Mr. Dunworthy. She's very despondent. Says she'll never forgive herself for letting the others down. I told her it wasn't her fault. But sometimes things are simply out of one's control, aren't they?
Yes,
Dunworthy said. He had not succeeded in reaching a tech, let alone persuading him to come to Oxford. And he had not found Basingham. He and Finch had phoned every hotel in Scotland, and then every inn and rental cottage. William had got hold of Basingham's credit records. But there were no purchases of fishing lures or waders in some remote Scottish town, as he had hoped, and no entries at all after the 15th of December. The telephone system was becoming progressively disabled. The visual cut out again, and the recorded voice, announcing that due to the epidemic all circuits were busy, interrupted after only 2 digits on nearly every call he tried to put through. He didn't so much worry about Kivrin as carry her with him, a heavy weight, as he punched and repunched the numbers, waited for ambulances, listened to Mrs. Gadsden's complaints. Andrews had not phoned back, or if he had not succeeded in getting through. The dream murmured endlessly of death, the nurses carefully transcribing his ramblings on slips of paper. While he waited for the techs, for the fishing guides, for someone to answer the telephone, he pored over Badri's words, searching for clues. Black, Badri had said, and laboratory, and Europe. The phone system grew worse. The recorded voice cut in as he punched the first number, and several times he couldn't raise a dial tone. He gave up for the moment and worked on the contacts chart. William had managed to get hold of the primary's confidential NHS medical records, and he pored over them, searching for radiation treatments and visits to the dentist. One of the primaries had had his jaw x-rayed, but on second look, he saw it had been on the 24th, after the epidemic began. He went over to infirmary to ask the primaries, who weren't delirious, whether they had any pets or had been duck hunting recently. The corridors were filled with stretcher trolleys, each one of them with a patient on it. They were jammed up against the doors of casualties and crosswise in front of the elevator. There was no way he could get past them to it. He took the stairs. William's blonde student nurse met him at the door of isolation. She was wearing a white cloth gown and mask. I'm afraid you can't go in, she said, holding up a gloved hand.
Badri's dead, he thought.
Is Mrs. Chadhari worse?
He asked. No. He seems actually to be resting a bit more quietly, but we've run out of SPGs. London's promised to send us a shipment tomorrow, and the staff's making do with cloth, but we haven't enough for visitors. She fished in her pocket for a scrap of paper. I wrote down his words, she said, handing it to him. I'm afraid most of it's unintelligible. He says your name and Kivrin's, is that right? He nodded, looking at the paper. And sometimes isolated words, but most of it's nonsense. She had tried to write it down phonetically, and when she understood a word, she underscored it. Can't, he had said, and rat, and so worried. Over half the detainees were down by Sunday morning, and everyone not ill was nursing them. Dunworthy and Finch had given up all notion of putting them in wards, and at any rate they'd run out of cots. They left them in their own beds, or moved them, bed and all, into rooms in Salvin to keep their makeshift nurses from running themselves ragged. The bell ringers fell one by one, and Dunworthy helped put them to bed in the old library. Miss Taylor, who could still walk, insisted on going to visit them. It's the least I can do, she said, panting after the exertion of walking across the corridor, after I let them down like that. Dunworthy helped her onto the air mattress William had carried over and covered her with a sheet. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak, he said. He felt weak himself. Bone-tired from the lack of sleep and the constant defeat. He had finally managed, between boiling water for tea and washing bedpans, to get through to one of Maudlin's texts. She's in hospital, her mother had said. She'd looked harried and tired. When did she fall ill? Dunworthy had asked her. Christmas Day. Hope had surged in him. Perhaps Maudlin's tech was the source. What symptoms does your daughter have? He'd asked eagerly. Headache, fever, disorientation. Ruptured appendix, she'd said. By Monday morning, 3/4 of the detainees were ill. They ran out, as Finch had predicted, of clean linens and NHS masks, and more urgently, of temps, antimicrobials, and aspirin. I tried to ring infirmary to ask for more, Finch said, handing Dunworthy a list. But the phones have all gone dead. Dunworthy walked to the infirmary to fetch the supplies. The street in front of casualties was jammed, a jumble of ambulance vans and taxis and protesters carrying a large sign that proclaimed, "The Prime Minister has left us here to die." As he squeezed past them and in the door, Colin came running out. He was wet as usual, and red-faced and red-nosed from the cold. His jacket was unstripped. "The telephones are out," he said. "There was an overload. I'm running messages." He pulled an untidy clutch of folded papers from his jacket pocket. "Is there anyone you'd like me to take a message to?"
"Yes," he thought. "To Andrews, to Basingham, to Kivrin."
"No,"
he said.
Colin stuffed the already wet messages back in his pocket. "I'm off, then. If you're looking for Great Aunt Mary, she's in casualties. 5 more cases just came in. Family. The baby was dead." He darted off through the traffic jam. Dunworthy pushed his way into casualties and showed his list to the house officer, who directed him to supplies. The corridors were still full of stretcher trolleys, though now they were lined lengthwise on both sides, so there was a narrow passage between. Bending over one of the stretcher trolleys was a nurse in a pink mask and gown reading something to one of the patients. "The Lord shall make the pestilence cleave unto thee," she said, and he realized too late that it was Mrs. Gadsden. But she was so intent on her reading, she did not look up. "Until he have consumed thee from the land."
"The pestilence shall cleave unto thee," he said silently, and thought of Badri.
"It was the rats," Badri had said. "It killed them all. Half of Europe."
"She can't be in the Black Death," he thought, turning down the corridor to the supplies. Andrews had said the maximal slippage was 5 years. In 1325, the plague hadn't even begun in China. Andrews had said the only two things that would not have automatically aborted the drop were the slippage and the coordinates. And Badrie, when he could answer Dunworthy's questions, insisted he had checked Pulkowski's coordinates. He went into supplies. There was no one at the desk. He rang the bell. Each time Dunworthy had asked him, Badrie had said the apprentice's coordinates were correct, but his fingers moved nervously over the sheet, typing in the fix. That can't be right. There's something wrong. He rang the bell again, and a nurse emerged from among the shelves. She had obviously come out of retirement expressly for the epidemic. She was 90 at the least, and her white uniform was yellowed with age, but still stiff with starch. It crackled when she took his list.
Have you a supply authorization?
No, he said. She handed him back his list and a 3-page form.
All orders must be authorized by the ward matron.
We haven't any ward matron, he said, his temper flaring. We haven't any ward. We have 50 detainees in 2 dormitories and no supplies.
In that case, authorization must be obtained from the doctor in charge.
The doctor in charge has an infirmary full of patients to take care of. She doesn't have time to sign authorizations. There's an epidemic on.
I am well aware of that,
the nurse said frigidly.
All orders must be signed by the doctor in charge.
And walked creakily back among the shelves. He went back to casualties. Mary was no longer there. The house officer sent him up to isolation, but she wasn't there either. He toyed with the idea of forging Mary's signature, but he wanted to see her. Wanted to tell her about his failure to reach the text, his failure to find a way to bypass Gilchrist and open the net. He could not even get a simple aspirin, and it was already the 3rd of January. He finally ran Mary to ground in the laboratory. She was speaking into the telephone, which was apparently working again, though the visual was nothing but snow. She wasn't watching it. She was watching the console, which had the branching contacts chart on it.
What exactly is the difficulty? She was saying. You said it would be here 2 days ago.
There was a pause while the person lost in the snow apparently made some sort of excuse.
What do you mean it was turned back? She said incredulously. I got 1,000 people with influenza here.
There was another pause. Mary typed something into the console and a different chart appeared.
Well, send it again, she shouted. I need it now. I've got people dying here. I want it here by... Hello? Are you there?
The screen went dead. She turned to click the receiver and caught sight of Dunworthy. She beckoned him into the office.
Are you there?
She said into the telephone.
Hello?
She slammed the receiver down. The phones don't work. Half my staff is down with the virus, and the analogues aren't here because some idiot wouldn't let them into the quarantine area, she said angrily. She sank down in front of the console and rubbed her fingers against her cheekbones. Sorry, she said. It's been rather a bad day. I've had 3 DOAs this afternoon. One of them was 6 months old. She was still wearing the sprig of holly on her lab coat. Both it and the lab coat were much the worse for wear, and Mary looked impossibly tired, the lines around her mouth and eyes cutting deeply into her face. He wondered how long it had been since she had slept, and whether, if he were to ask her, she would even know. She rubbed 2 fingers along the lines above her eyes.
One never gets used to the idea that there is nothing one can do, she said.
No.
She looked up at him, almost as if she hadn't realized he was there. Was there something you needed, James? She had had no sleep and no help and 3 DOAs, one of them a baby. She had enough on her mind without worrying over Kivrin.
No,
he said, standing up. He handed her the form.
Nothing but your signature.
She signed it without looking at it.
I went to see Gilchrist this morning,
she said, handing it back to him. He looked at her, too surprised and touched to speak.
I went to see if I could convince him to open the net earlier. I explained that there's no need to wait until there's been full immunization. Immunization of a critical percentage of the virus pool effectively eliminates the contagion vectors. None of your arguments had the slightest effect on him?
Nope.
He's utterly convinced the virus came through from the past,
Mary sighed.
He's drawn up charts of the cyclical mutation patterns of type A myxoviruses. According to them, one of the type A myxoviruses extant in 1318 to 19 was an H9N2.
She rubbed at her forehead again.
He won't open the laboratory until full immunization's been completed and the quarantine's lifted. And when will that be?
He asked, though he had a good idea.
Quarantine has to remain in effect until 7 days after full immunization or 14 days after final incidence, she said, as if she were giving him bad news.
Final incidence. 2 weeks with no new cases.
How long will nationwide immunization take?
Once we get sufficient supplies of the vaccine, not long. The pandemic only took 18 days.
18 days? After sufficient supplies of the vaccine were manufactured, the end of January?
Well, that's not soon enough, he said.
I know. We must positively identify the source, that's all.
She turned to look at the console.
The answer's in here, you know. We're simply looking in the wrong place. She punched in a new chart. I've been running correlations, looking for veterinary students, primaries who live near zoos, rural addresses. This one's of secondaries listed in Debrett's, grouse hunting and all that. But the closest any of them's come to a waterfowl is eating goose for Christmas. She punched up the contacts chart. Badri's name was still at the top of it. She sat and looked at it a long moment, as remote as Montoya staring at her bones.
The first thing a doctor has to learn is not to be too hard on himself when he loses a patient, she said. And he wondered if she meant Kivrin or Badri.
I'm going to get the net open, he said.
I hope so, she said. The answer did not lie in the context charts or the commonalities. It lay in Badri, whose name was still, in spite of all the questions they had asked the primaries, in spite of all the false leads, the source. Badri was the index case. And sometime in the 4 to 6 days before the drop, he had been in contact with the reservoir. He went up to see him. There was a different nurse at the desk outside Badri's room, a tall, nervous youth who looked no more than 17.
Where's...
Dunworthy began and realized he didn't know the blonde nurse's name.
She's down with it, the boy said. Yesterday. She's the 20th of the nursing staff to catch it, and they're out of subs. They asked for third-year students to help. I'm actually only first year, but I've had first aid training.
Yesterday. A whole day had passed then with no one recording what Badri had said.
Do you remember anything Badri might have said while you were in with him?
He said without hope, a first-year student.
Any words or phrases you could understand?
You're Mr. Dunworthy, aren't you? The boy said. He handed him a set of SPGs. Eloise said you wanted to know everything the patient said. Dunworthy put on the newly arrived SPGs. They were white and marked with tiny black crosses along the back opening of the gown. He wondered where they'd resorted to borrowing them from. She was awfully ill, and she kept saying over and over how important it was. The boy led Dunworthy into Badri's room, looked at the screens above the bed, and then down at Badri. At least he looks at the patient, Dunworthy thought. Badri lay with his arms outside the sheet, plucking at it with hands that looked like those in Colin's illustration of the knight's tomb. His sunken eyes were open, but he did not look at the nurse, or at Dunworthy, or at the sheet, which his ceaseless hands could not seem to grasp. I read about this in meds, the boy said, but I've never actually seen it. It's a common terminal symptom in respiratory cases. He went to the console, punched something up, and pointed at the top left screen. I've written it all down. He had. Even the gibberish. He had written that phonetically, with ellipses to represent pauses and seek after questionable words. Half, he had written, and backer, seek, and why doesn't he come? This is mostly from yesterday, he said. He moved a cursor to the lower third of the screen. He talked a bit this morning. Now, of course, he doesn't say anything. Dunworthy sat down beside Badri and took his hand. It was ice cold, even through the imperm glove. He glanced at the temp screen. Badri no longer had a fever or the dark flush that had gone with it. He seemed to have lost all colour. His skin was the colour of wet ashes.
Badri, he said. It's Mr. Dunworthy. I need to ask you some questions.
There was no response. His cold hand lay limply in Dunworthy's gloved one, and the other continued picking steadily, uselessly, at the sheet.
Dr. Orange thinks you might have caught your illness from an animal, a wild duck or a goose.
The nurse looked interestedly at Dunworthy and then back at Badri, as if he were hoping he would exhibit another yet unobserved medical phenomenon.
Badri, can you remember? Did you have any contact with ducks or geese the week before the drop?
Badri's hand moved. Dunworthy frowned at it, wondering if he were trying to communicate, but when he loosened his grip a little, the thin, thin fingers were only trying to pluck at his palm, at his fingers, at his wrist. He was suddenly ashamed that he was sitting here torturing Badri with questions. Though he was past hearing, past even knowing Dunworthy was here or caring. He laid Badri's hand back on the sheet.
Rest, he said, patting it gently. Try to rest.
I doubt if he can hear you, the nurse said. When they're this far gone, they're not really conscious.
No, I know, Dunworthy said.
But he went on sitting there. The nurse adjusted a drip, peered nervously at it, and adjusted it again. He looked anxiously at Badri, adjusted the drip a third time, and finally went out. Dunworthy sat on, watching Badri's fingers plucking blindly at the sheet. Trying to grasp it, but unable to. Trying to hold on. Now and then he murmured something, too soft to hear. Dunworthy rubbed his arm gently up and down. After a while, the plucking grew slower, though Dunworthy didn't know if that was a good sign or not. graveyard,
Badri said. No, Dunworthy said. No.
He sat on a bit longer, rubbing Badri's arm, but after a little it seemed to make his agitation worse. He stood up.
Try to rest, he said, and went out. The nurse was sitting at the desk, reading a copy of Patient Care. Please notify me when... Dunworthy said, and realized he would not be able to finish the sentence. Please notify me.
Yes, sir, the boy said. Where are you?
He fumbled in his pocket for a scrap of paper to write on and came up with a list of supplies. He had nearly forgotten it.
I'm at Balliol, he said. Send a messenger.
And went back down to supplies.
You haven't filled this out properly, the crone said startily when Dunworthy gave her the form.
I've got it signed, he said, handing her his list. You fill it out.
She looked disapprovingly at the list.
We haven't any masks or temps. She reached down a small bottle of aspirin. We're out of synthamycin and AZO.
The bottle of aspirin contained perhaps 20 tablets. He put them in his pocket and walked down to the hide of the chemist. A small crowd of protesters stood outside in the rain holding pickets that said unfair and price gouging. He went inside. They were out of masks, and the temps and the aspirin were outrageously priced. He bought all they had. He spent the night dispensing them and studying Badri's chart, looking for some clue to the virus's source. Badri had run an on-site for 19th century in Hungary on the 10th of December, but the chart did not say where in Hungary, and William, who was flirting with the detainees who were still on their feet, didn't know, and the phones were out again. They were still out in the morning when Dunworthy tried to phone to check on Badri's condition. He could not even raise a dialing tone, but as soon as he put down the receiver, the telephone rang. It was Andrews. Dunworthy could scarcely hear his voice through the static.
Sorry this took so long, he said.
And then something that was lost entirely.
I can't hear you, Dunworthy said. I said I've had difficulty getting through. The phones...
More static.
I did the parameter checks. I used three different L and L's and triangulated the...
The rest was lost.
What was the maximal slippage?
He shouted into the phone. The line went momentarily clear.
6 days. That was with an L and L of...
More static.
I ran probabilities in the possible maximal for any L and L's within a circumference of 50 kilometers was still 5 years.
The static roared in again, and the line went dead. Dunworthy put the receiver down. He should have felt reassured, but he could not seem to summon any feeling. Gilchrist had no intention of opening the net on January the 6th, whether Kivrin was there or not. He reached for the phone to phone the Scottish Tourism Bureau, and as he did, it rang again.
Dunworthy here,
he said, squinting at the screen, but the visuals were still nothing but snow.
Who?
A woman's voice that sounded hoarse or groggy said.
Sorry,
it murmured.
I meant to ring.
And something else too blurred to make out, and the visual went blank. He waited to see if it would ring again, and then went back across to Salvin. Mordrin's bell was chiming the hour. Sounded like a funeral bell in the unceasing rain. Miss Piantini had apparently heard the bell too. She was standing in the quad in her nightgown, solemnly raising her arms in an unheard rhythm.
Middle, wrong, and into the hunt, she said,
when Dunworthy tried to take her back inside. Finch appeared looking distraught. "It's the bell, sir," he said, taking hold of her other arm. "They upset her. I don't think they should ring them under the circumstances." Miss Piantini wrenched free of Dunworthy's restraining hand. "Every man must stick to his bell without interruption," she said furiously. "I quite agree," Finch said, clutching her arm as firmly as if it were a bell rope, and led her back to her cot. Colin came skidding in, drenched as usual and nearly blue with cold. His jacket was open, and Mary's grey muffler dangled uselessly about his neck. He handed Dunworthy a message. "It's from Badri's nurse," he said, opening a packet of soap tablets and popping a light blue one into his mouth. The note was drenched too. It read, "Badri asking for you," though the word Badri was so blurred he couldn't make out more than the B.
"Did the nurse say whether Badri was worse?"
"Nope, just to give you the message. And Great Aunt Mary says when you come, you're to get your enhancement. She said she doesn't know when the analogue will get here." Dunworthy helped Finch wrestle Miss Piantini into bed and hurried to infirmary and up to isolation. There was another new nurse, this one a middle-aged woman with swollen feet. She was sitting with them propped up on the screens, watching a pocket vidder, but she stood up immediately when he came in. "Are you Mr. Dunworthy?" she asked, blocking his way. "Dr. Arryn says you're to meet her downstairs immediately." She said it quietly, even kindly, and he thought, "She's trying to spare me. She doesn't want me to see what's in there. She wants Mary to tell me first." "It's Badri, isn't it? He's dead." She looked genuinely surprised.
"Oh, no. He's much better this morning. Didn't you get my note? He's sitting up."
"Sitting up?" he said, staring at her, wondering if she were delirious with fever.
"He's still very weak, of course, but his temp's normal and he's alert. You're to meet Dr. Arryn's in casualties. She said it was urgent."
He looked wonderingly toward the door to Badri's room. "Tell him I'll be in to see him as soon as I can," he said, and hurried out the door. He nearly collided with Colin, who was apparently coming in.
"What are you doing here?" he demanded. "Did one of the techs telephone?"
"I've been assigned to you," Colin said. "Great Aunt Mary says she doesn't trust you to get your T-cell enhancement. I'm supposed to take you down to get it."
"I can't. There's an emergency in casualties," he said, walking rapidly down the corridor.
Colin ran to keep up with him. "Well then, after the emergency, she said I wasn't to let you leave infirmary without it." Mary was there to meet them when the lift opened.
"We have another case," she said grimly. "It's Montoya."
She started for casualties.
"They're bringing her in from Whitney."
"Montoya?" Dunworthy said. "That's impossible. She's been out in the dig alone."
He pushed open the double doors.
"Apparently not.
But she said..."
"Are you certain it's the virus? She's been working in the rain. Perhaps it's some other disease."
Mary shook her head.
"The ambulance team ran a prelim. It matches the virus."
She stopped at the admissions desk and asked the house officer,
"Are they here yet?"
He shook his head.
"They've just come through the perimeter."
Mary walked over to the doors and looked out, as if she didn't believe him. "We got a call from her this morning, very confused," she said, turning back to them. "I telephoned to Chipping Norton, which is the nearest hospital, told them to send an ambulance. But they said the dig was officially under quarantine, and I couldn't get one of ours out to her. I finally had to persuade the NHS to grant a dispensation to send an ambulance." She peered out the doors again.
"When did she go out to the dig?"
"I..." Dunworthy tried to remember.
She had phoned to ask him about the Scottish fishing guide on Christmas Day and then phoned back that afternoon to say never mind, because she had decided to forge Basingham's signature instead.
Christmas Day, he said. If the NHS offices were open. Or the 26th. No, that was Boxing Day. 27th. And she hasn't seen anyone since then.
How do you know?
When I spoke to her, she was complaining that she couldn't keep the dig dry single-handed. She wanted me to phone to the NHS to ask for students to help her.
How long ago was that?
3 days ago, he said, frowning.
The days ran together when one never got to bed.
Could she have found someone at the farm to help after she spoke to you? There's no one there in the winter. As I remember, Montoya recruits anyone who comes within reach. Perhaps she enlisted some passerby. She said there weren't any. The dig's very isolated.
Well, she must have found someone. She's been out at the dig for 7 days, and the incubation period's only 12 to 48 hours.
The ambulance is here, Colin said.
Mary pushed out the doors, Dunworthy and Colin on her heels. Two ambulance men in masks lifted a stretcher out and onto a trolley. Dunworthy recognized one of them. He had helped bring Badrian. Colin was bending over the stretcher, looking interestedly at Montoya, who lay with her eyes closed. Her head was propped up with pillows, and her face was flushed the same heavy red as Miss Breen's had been. Colin leaned farther over her, and she coughed directly in his face. Dunworthy grabbed the collar of Colin's jacket and dragged him away from her.
Come away from there! Are you trying to catch the virus? Why aren't you wearing your mask?
There aren't any.
You shouldn't be here at all. I want you to go straight back to Balliol and...
I can't. I'm assigned to make certain you get your enhancement.
Then sit down over there,
Dunworthy said, walking him over to a chair in the reception area,
and stay away from the patients.
You'd better not try to sneak out on me,
Colin said warningly. But he sat down, pulled his gobstopper out of his pocket and wiped it on the sleeve of his jacket. Dunworthy went back over to the stretcher trolley. Lupe, Mary was saying, we need to ask you some questions. When did you fall ill?
This morning,
Montoya said. Her voice was hoarse, and Dunworthy realized suddenly that she must be the person who had telephoned him.
Last night I had a terrible headache.
She raised a muddy hand and drew it across her eyebrows.
But I thought it was because I was straining my eyes.
Who was with you out at the dig?
Nobody,
Montoya said, sounding surprised. What about deliveries? Did someone from Whitney deliver supplies to you?
She started to shake her head, but it apparently hurt, and she stopped. No, I took everything with me.
And you didn't have anyone with you to help you with the excavation?
No. I asked Mr. Dunworthy to tell the NHS to send some help, but he didn't.
Mary looked across at Dunworthy, and Montoya followed her glance.
Are they sending someone?
She asked him.
They'll never find it if they don't get someone out there.
Find what?
He said, wondering if Montoya's answer could be trusted or if she were half delirious.
The dig is half underwater right now, she said.
Find what?
Kivrin's quarter.
He had a sudden image of Montoya standing by the tomb, sorting through the muddy box of stone-shaped bones. Wrist bones. They had been wrist bones, and she had been examining the uneven edges, looking for a bone spur that was actually a piece of recording equipment. Kivrin's quarter.
I haven't excavated all the graves yet, Montoya said. And it's still raining. They have to send someone out immediately.
Grave? Mary said, looking at him uncomprehendingly. What is she talking about?
She's been excavating a medieval churchyard looking for Kivrin's body, he said bitterly. Looking for the corder you implanted in Kivrin's wrist.
Mary wasn't listening.
I want the contacts charts, she said to the house officer. She turned back to Dunworthy. Badree was out at the dig, wasn't he?
Yes.
When?
The 18th and 19th, he said.
In the churchyard?
Yes. He and Montoya were opening a knight's tomb.
A tomb, Mary said, as if it were the answer to a question. She bent over Montoya. How old was the tomb?
1318, Montoya said.
Did you work on the knight's tomb this week? Mary asked.
Montoya tried to nod, stopped. I get so dizzy when I move my head, she said apologetically. I had to move the skeleton. Water had gotten into the tomb.
Which day did you work on the tomb?
Montoya frowned. I can't remember.
The day before the bells, I think.
The 31st, Dunworthy said.
He leaned over her.
Have you worked on it since?
She tried to shake her head again.
The contacts charts are up, the house officer said.
Mary walked rapidly over to his desk and took the keyboard over from him. She tapped several keys, stared at the screen, tapped more keys.
What is it?
Dunworthy said.
What are the conditions of the churchyard? Mary said.
Conditions?
He said blankly.
It's muddy. She's covered the churchyard with a tarp, but a good deal of rain was still getting in.
Warm?
Yes. She mentioned it was muggy. She had several electric fires hooked up. What is it?
She drew her finger down the screen, looking for something.
Viruses are exceptionally sturdy organisms, she said. They can lie dormant for long periods of time and be revived. Living viruses have been taken from Egyptian mummies. Her finger stopped at a date.
I thought so.
Badree was at the dig 4 days before he came down with the virus.
She turned to the house officer.
I want a team out at the dig immediately, she told him. Get NHS clearance. Tell them we may have found the source of the virus.
She typed in a new screen, drew her finger down the names, typed in something else and leaned back, looking at the screen.
We had 4 primaries with no positive connection to Badree. 2 of them were at the dig 4 days before they came down with the virus. The other one was there 3 days before.
The virus is at the dig?
Dunworthy said.
Yes.
She smiled ruefully at him.
I'm afraid Gilchrist was right after all. The virus did come from the past. Out of the knight's tomb.
This ends side 1 of cassette 13. Please turn the cassette over and start side 2 at the same point.